So good morning, everyone, and welcome to our Book of Ruth, Kindness to Strangers class in memory of Shirley Yellen on the occasion of her 20th yahrzeit. Yezekro Baruch, her memory should be a blessing and all of the learning should be an aliyah, an elevation for her soul. So today we're going to do a little retrospective of the Book of Ruth, the Kindness to Strangers. Of course, Ruth was an integral part of Shavuot that we just celebrated a week ago, the holiday called the Feast of Weeks, where we commemorate Matan Torah, the giving of our Torah, the Ten Commandments, etc., at Mount Sinai. And the Book of Ruth is an integral part of the experience. There's a custom, worldwide custom, to read Ruth during the story of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments that we read about. We also read about the amazing Ruth. So I want to talk about the nature of kindness. So in order to understand chesed, kindness, we need to have a little bit of a backstory, right? A little context. So here's the context. Our world was created with acts of ultimate chesed by God. It literally says in our liturgy that ha'olam yibana, that the world was built on kindness. Clearly, God, Hashem, had kindness towards us. He also gave us opportunity in his magical creation that we as humans could join the chesed, the kindness connection to God, and emulate God through kindness. And we'll speak about that much more in depth in a few moments. But we need to understand the origin story of the Moabites in order to really detail and flesh out the nature of chesed, of kindness. So here's the story. Abraham and Sarah go down to a place called Egypt. And it wasn't the nefarious Pharaoh, the Yul Brynner Pharaoh that happened later. This is an earlier version of Pharaoh, different model, but not such a good guy. So on their way down, they have Lot, L-O-T. And who is Lot? Lot is the nephew of Abraham and brother of Sarah. People overlook that little fact. But that's a little biblical fact that people are like, what? Their brother and sister? Yes. So Lot goes with them to Egypt, along with whatever they have in terms of their wealth. And they head down to Egypt. Why? Because God had told Abraham, Lechucha me'artzucha, leave your homeland back in wherever there was, Turkey, Iraq, where they were living. Come to the promised land. As soon as he arrives in the promised land, which was called Canaan, Canaan at the time, because the Canaanites occupied the land, there's a ra'av, there's a famine in the land, which echoes the idea of the famine that we opened the Book of Ruth with. So what happens? Abraham and Sarah head down to Egypt. And Abraham says to Sarah, I am aware of how beautiful you are. And I also know the lack of morals here in Egypt. And we're going to be facing a crisis situation. They're going to look at you as this incredible, beautiful woman, and they're going to say she is a woman perhaps fit for marriage to the king. So please do a chesed, do a kindness for me. When we go, just tell people that we're brother and sister so they won't take me, torture me, and kill me. And of course, Sarah does this. Lot hears the conversation, and he also silences himself. So they come to Egypt, and again, they ask about Sarah right away at the border. The TSA agents are waiting there, and they see the woman. They say, who's the beautiful woman? So they don't say that she doesn't have a husband. They don't say that out loud. They just say that Abraham and her are like brother and sister. So they come. Pharaoh, of course, takes Sarah. God comes to Pharaoh and says, return her, or you and your kingdom are finished. So Pharaoh acquiesces, gives back Sarah. He gives Sarah a gift of land that you're familiar with, Goshen. Not only is Goshen, is a Goshen, New York, that you go through on Route 17 when you're going down from 84 to part south. Goshen is this little territory outside of the major Alexandria, Cairo areas, where eventually the Jewish people in the time of Joseph and the brothers, they would relocate there, and it was there ancestral homeland in Egypt, because it had been given as a present, as a kapara, an atonement by Pharaoh for having taken Sarah. And then he gives Sarah and Abraham tremendous rechush, great wealth, camels, and lots of interesting things. So they head back, and then the Torah tells us that they come to the land, Vegam Lelot, and also to Lot, who had traveled with Abraham. He had servants and a stock portfolio, mamash. Remember back then, your stock portfolio was not a conceptual metaphor for something held somewhere on a bunch of pixels on a computer screen. Your stock portfolio was mamish, as they say in Yiddish. It was literal stock, right? That's how you described your wealth. And so Lot had stock, tremendous wealth, because he was enriched by Pharaoh as a result of having kept mum about the relationship between Sarah and Abraham. So he's also benefiting. So what's the difference? The difference is Lot doesn't want to muzzle his sheepala, and he eventually is given by Abraham a choice. Either you muzzle your sheep because we dare not take land that doesn't belong to us. Lot says, but wait a minute, Uncle Abraham, didn't you teach us that this entire land was promised to you by God? He says, yeah, but that's a future event that hasn't happened. That's going to happen when Joshua conquers the land. But now it's Canaanite land. And if you want to feed your animals, pay for the, muzzle the sheepala, so that when they are pasturing out in the pasture lands, they're not ganavim. They're not thieves. Lot doesn't like this. And so Abraham says, if you won't change your ways, I can't have it that you publicly desecrate the name of God. Because everyone associates me, Abraham says to Lot, with Hashem. And you and I look very similar. So when they see you committing an act of geneva, of theft, they're going to associate it with me. And I can't have that. I can't have God's name being profaned. What's called a chilul Hashem, profaning God's name. It's not good. So if you will not cease and desist and muzzle the sheep the way I muzzle my sheep, then you and I can't live together. So choose where you're going to go. Now, what should Lot's reaction have been to Abraham at that moment? Oh, please, uncle, I love you. Whatever it is, I'll do. I'll make the change. No. He immediately has like the dollar signs in his eyes. And he's looking for a place to relocate away from Abraham. And of course, infamously, he goes to Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay. So he gets to Sodom and Gomorrah. And right away, they elevate him to like the judge of Sodom and Gomorrah. Because, you know, he's a special guy, though. Compared to those guys, he's the Talmud Chacham. He's the great rabbi there. And so they promote him. And as far as him hoarding his cash, that's not a problem in Sodom and Gomorrah, because everybody hoards their cash in Sodom and Gomorrah. In fact, you're not allowed to have guests or host strangers. They were so fearful of outside eyes coming to Sodom and Gomorrah that they don't want any of that, right? So it was actually a commandment, Sodom and Gomorrah, if you have hachnasas orchim, if you do the expression of kindness through having guest to your home, it's a capital crime. We'll kill you for it. And so that's why the famous story, which I'll say very quickly to you, you know the story of how Lot hosts the two angels, and they have like a little, perhaps a Passover meal together. The town goes nuts. They come around. They want to do their worst to Lot. Lot offers up his daughters, and they end up barely escaping with their lives. Lot, Mrs. Lot, who unfortunately looked back at the destruction and became a pillar of salt, and then the two daughters, and they leave Sodom and Gomorrah. They have a little place in a cave up next to where the devastation has occurred, and unbeknownst to the two daughters, the world is not destroyed. The devastation is limited to the Kikar HaYarden, to the cities of that area of the Jordan. So they horrifically get their father drunk, they have relationships, and you have two children, Moav. May from of dad. His name literally means from dad. Nice of her not to embarrass herself or her father with the incest. Yikes. So this is the ignoble beginning of Moab. Okay. But what do you learn from here? You learn a couple of powerful takeaways into the mind of Moab. Now remember, when we're discussing Moab, Ruth is a Moabitess, a Moaviyah. So this is going to relate directly to Ruth, although she transcends the negativity that we're going to talk about. So in the mind of a Moabite, how do you do kindness? Kindness can't be given if it's going to make me beholden to the giver. In other words, if I'm accepting your offer of friendship, your hand up, and if it's going to make me dependent upon you, not going to go there. And we all know that, unfortunately, there are people in our world today who, when they perform kindness for another, they create a dependent relationship. And it can make you actually feel, I hate to use the word icky, but that's kind of the way it makes you feel. You feel there's something a little unholy here, that I'm getting benefit, but it's coming at a personal cost where part of who I am, you're making me feel either covertly or overtly dependent upon you. There's a part of me that is beholden to you, and it doesn't feel great. It's much nicer to give it anonymously, do it in a way that protects the dignity and protects the individual's self. Okay, so clearly then, anyone from Moab is going to be very sensitive to us. Now, how do we know that? So I quoted you a couple words from the Torah. It says, Vigam Lilot, also for Lot, who traveled with Abraham and Sarah, he had great wealth. So Lot had an issue. You see, Abraham is the paradigm of kindness, of chesed. Only poor Lot felt that he was subsumed within the greater Abraham umbrella of kindness. It wasn't intentional, God forbid. We're not critiquing, God forbid, Abraham. He was Abraham. So Abraham and Sarah never created dependent relationships that would make the receiver feel icky. That wasn't the case. But it doesn't matter. If the recipient feels that way, then it's a legitimate feeling. Lot felt that I will always be second to Abraham. I don't have my own identity. Begum, and also Lot, meaning also to Abraham, he had money. He's never, so I use the analogy, which you've heard me use, I think it's very cute, if I can say so myself, sorry, I don't mean to be pompous. So you have the greatest, most famous superhero of all time, it's not a superhero, Batman. And then you have the guy wearing the very chalushas, that means like very bright wardrobe, and his name is Robin, right? So you have Robin and Batman. Yikes. So everyone loves Batman. Now, he's the most beloved comic strip person in history, right? But everyone kind of looks at Robin askance, like what? Like, he has no superpowers, and you got to wear that ridiculous costume. So you can imagine in the mind of poor Robin, I'm just having fun now with poor Robin, he's like Lot. He always wants to be the man, the Cape Crusader, the man behind the mask, who has the cool toys, right? That's my favorite line. They made a movie, and I think the Flash, remember the Flash who had actual superpowers, Barry Allen? He asks Batman, so what are your superpowers? Because he knows he doesn't have any. He says, I'm rich. I'm rich. That's his superpower. He can afford all the toys. So Lot is Robin in our metaphor here. And he desperately, desperately wants to be the Batman. And so he feels that if I'm away from Batman, far enough away, it'll be okay. Now, how do we know this is true? Because the angels say, hey, we're going to bring you back to Abraham. How does that sound? You know what Lot says? No, I'm not returning. Kill me now. Because the angel said, Hahara Nasu, let's flee to the mountain. And the rabbis say, well, who is the mountain? That's Abraham. He's considered the mountain in the metaphor. And what does Lot say? I can't go back to, I can't be Robin anymore. So if it means going back to Abraham, I'm not leaving here. Just wipe me out with everybody else. And so they create a miracle for him, and he survives in Sohar, in this cave. Okay. So now we see the mind of Lot. Yeah? That he feels that somehow within the confines of Abraham's enormous compassion and kindness, he feels that he loses himself, his identity of who he is. Wow. So now we understand the mind of the Moabite. So now let's fast forward to our story. Yay, we get to the book of Ruth a little bit. Just a little bit. So in this story, where does the scene begin? Scene one, in the fields of Moab. Yeah, well, it's ironic, but that's what happens. There's a famine in the land of Israel because people are bad to each other. There's no compassion or kindness. It is a society that is horrific. And the famine is perhaps an expression of how horrific they are to each other. And they had a man named Elimelech, who is potentially the savior of that generation. He's the Musk and Bezos and Larry, the Google guy, the Jewish guy. I can't remember. Larry. I'm having a senior moment. Who's the guy who owns Google? It's Larry something.
Ellison.
Thank you. So he's the, all of these guys wrapped up into one. And you know what he doesn't want to happen? He doesn't want schnors, people coming to his palatial estate and knocking on the door. Can you give me some tzedakah, some charity? He doesn't want that. And so when he sees the reality of the severity of the famine, he cuts loose and he betrays the people. He should have thought, well, why did God give me the wherewithal to help people? Because he put me in a position where I could save all of the Jews. No. So he runs away to Moab and he brings Naomi with him, his wife, and their two children, Mahlon and Chilion, which translated loosely mean death and destruction. Yeah, I've never been at like a bris milah circumcision where they announce the name of a little boy. Bikarei Shema Bisrael, let his name be called among the Jewish people. Death and disease. I don't know if I could pinch myself. You know, you never know. All right. So the kids, everybody comes with him to Moab. Not that Naomi and the kids want to come, but dad's going, so we're going. What choice? And then the guys find Moabite women, and they ostensibly recruit them. Maybe they teach them a little bit about God. They convert them, and they get married. One of them is named Orpah, and one of them is named Ruth. And they are, we are told, princesses. And they're married into a princely family. And once again, how do you think the Moabites react when they see the richest Jew in all of Israel come with all of his stock portfolio and everything off? You know, he brings the Cayman Islands accounts to the fields of Moab. You know what they're doing? They're cheering him. They're saying, you know, Shalom Aleichem, Kum Terein, welcome. This is how Moabites behave. We don't want to share anything because their roots are in Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where Moab was created, was impregnated and born. So therefore, it's the same mindset. So they're happy to have a Jew who doesn't want to share. So they welcome Elimelech and they allow King Eglon's daughters or granddaughters, Orpah and Ruth, marry into the family. And then God is unhappy. And God starts to send disease and stuff by way of Elimelech. Does he get the message? No. And then eventually he gets sick. Does he get the message and return? No. He dies. And then eventually the kids, do they return? No. So they die. God gave them lots of years of gentle and not so gentle persuasion. And they're not persuaded. They don't get the signs from heaven. That's it. So what happens? You have Naomi, who's lost her husband, so she's a widow, and her beautiful sons. So she's old, she has no stock portfolio, it's all gone, because God took care of that as a way of motivating Elimelech, so there's no money there. All she has in her mind, she's bereft, she's rake, empty. Now she has the magical Ruth, so she's not really empty, but she perceives herself as being bereft of the world. So she decides during Passover, I have to head back to Israel. I've heard that the famine has ended. God is now back and friendly with the Jewish people, kind of. So I'm going to return home. So what do Ruth and Naomi do? They accompany her on the road. And we know the famous story. It's, in fact, right here in chapter 1, right, where she basically tells Orpah and Ruth, the sensible action for you ladies, I love you both. I love your fidelity to me. I love the fact that you're not suing me in court for like the support from my dead sons. You're letting that go, okay? But go home. And Orpah kisses her and says goodbye, and she leaves the scene. Ruth clings to her, Davka. She emotionally, she says, I'm with you only till death do us part. So it's famous. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. And they go back to Bethlehem, okay? So let's talk about kindness for now. Let me ask you, Naomi, I understand that there might be some ill will towards her husband, Elimelech, because, I mean, my gosh, the guy betrayed Israel in its time of need, yeah? But what would a normative society do for poor Naomi and Ruth? I don't know. They would knock on the door Erev Shabbat with some challah and some kugel and some chicken. They'd say, hey, you know, we have a widow here. This poor woman has, like, literally no clothes to wear. She's, like, torn garments. No. Nobody even thinks to reach out to them. So they're staying there. They have no food. They're going to die. I mean, that's how insane the society is. In other words, it's so anti-Jewish to be literally the role model of Moab, kind of, right? So what happens next is that Ruth is forced to glean. So there's a rule that when the farmer would farm in Israel, and he would have gleanings, things that would sort of, during the harvest, would fall down, poor people would come into the field and pick up the gleanings. It's a rule in the Torah. So Ruth was forced to do this. And she happens to go to the field that belongs to Boaz. Boaz takes note of her because she's very tsanua. She's very modest. And she's incredibly drop-dead gorgeous. But she's protective of not showing how beautiful she is to the outsider. So she sits in a way that's very modest. He takes note of her and he offers to take care of her. And here's where we get to what today's class is focused on. Ready? Because we've been talking all about kindness. He says to Ruth, my dear, don't go anywhere else. Stay in my field. I am the chief judge of all of Israel. My name is Boaz. And I'll take care of you here. I've already ordered my foreman and the workers here to not mess with you. In fact, we're even going to get extra food for you, wink, wink, that will be yours. No conditions here, nothing at all. If you get thirsty, you can go to the little fridge over there and get a Coca-Cola for yourself that usually my workers take. Like, it's yours, yeah? And she looks at him, and you might say, well, she's suspicious because she's a young, beautiful woman and he's this old guy, yeah? But that's not the issue at all, the rabbi said. The issue is a fundamental issue of dependency. So you know what Ruth's response to Boaz is? Why did I find favor in your eyes, my master, my lord? How come you're doing this for me? So she is Moabite suspicious of what's going on. So what does she not want? She does not want to be dependent upon another person. So this is Moab 101. Yeah? But it's also a key to how we should interrelate on an interpersonal level with other people to help preserve their dignity. So Boaz, who is Judah, he is from Judah and knows how to do kindness. He learned it from Abraham and Sarah and his great-grandmother, Rebecca, who is the purveyor of incredible kindness. So we've given a class about that. Remember the camel kindness that we once gave a class on? Anybody remembers that? It's kind of hopefully memorable. So Judah had all that, and then Boaz, as chief rabbi, he understands the mindset of Ruth. So Ruth is questioning and refusing to accept, no matter how vulnerable she is at the moment, and she has nothing. He's basically saying, stay in my field. There's barley, then there'll be the wheat harvest, and I've already asked for protection of you by my men. Nobody will molest you or hurt you or push you away. And we'll give you extra food. And he offers from the feast to take home food for Naomi. Things are looking great. And Ruth steps back and says, Lama emsachim b'nei Adoni? How come I found favor in my master's eyes? So this is the crucial moment. So you know what Boaz says? My dear, what am I offering you? A little bit of food? A little bit of protection? Come on. I'm the richest guy in Israel, now that your father-in-law, Elimelech, is dead. I'm the richest guy in all of Israel, and this is not an issue for me. But more than that, I already heard reports. I know everything about who you are and how you stuck with my cousin Naomi in her time of need. How you married into the family, and how you accompanied Naomi on this lonely journey back, how you took upon yourself an oath to God to become Jewish. You are a light and a superstar. And through your love for God and for the Jewish people, I now have a greater appreciation of what it means to be a member of God's people. You have elevated me and inspired me. So all the little food and protection that I'm offering you is garnished. It is nothing compared to what you've already given to me. So she smiles and she says, if that's true, okay, okay, if that's true, I accept your generosity. So what did Boaz just set in motion. Incredible, right? Mutuality in the relationship. It's not going to be the beneficiary is going to be beholden to the benefactor. No. Boaz touches the heart of Ruth the Moabitess, and he confronts successfully, perhaps for the first time ever, the ability to understand Lot's mind, the poor Robin character from Batman, and he understands the reluctance. But as soon as he assures poor Ruth that he's not going to make her dependent upon him at all, that he's given basically whatever little food as a response to untold, incredibly valued inspiration that she's already taught him. So therefore, what has he given her? Herself, intact. She's not feeling beholden. She feels, oh my gosh, wow. If I've already done this for you and you're giving me a little bit of food, sure, I accept that. That's mutual relationship. That's perfect. So when she goes home to Naomi later that day, and Naomi could see her coming with like piles of grain and food, and she says, blessed be the man who took note of you today, Ruth. Who was the man who took note of you? You know what Ruth's response is? Don't ask who the man was. Ask what I did for this man today. Meaning as much as he did for us, I already made his world. I inspired him. I made him himself. So you see this incredible paradigm of a relationship that exists where both parts of the relationship feel a mutual power and that one is not dependent upon the other. This is the kindness of strangers. In this one moment, all those magical years that Ruth and Naomi spent together have come to a closure here at this moment. There, and Boaz has reignited true kindness. And whatever issues Lot felt towards Abraham all those hundreds and hundreds of years ago have now come full circle. And there's a closure right now of that circle. Lot, in other words, through the persona of Ruth, has come home, because he never came home in his life. He never went back to Abraham, just like he said to the angels, I can't go back to the mountain. He died before he ever reunited with Abraham. Even after Abraham saved his life and did all these things for him, he never came home. Ruth has now brought Moab and Lot, who were lost to the Jewish people. So those components, those genetics, have now returned in the persona of the magical Ruth. And we've also learned from them how we do chesed, how we do kindness. It's an incredible thing. So as we go from here forward, my prayer for all of us is that we should continue to do acts of chesed, of kindness for each other. And again, that mutuality should always be front and center right here, that when we're doing something, allow the other otherness. Make room for them to be themselves. And it's great to envelop them in love and warmth, but allow them room to reciprocate to us. And I'll leave you with a saying that comes from the rabbis on this verse where Boaz and Ruth are having this give and take about, why are you doing this for me? You know, and then Boaz assures her, you've already given to me. So you know what the rabbis say? More than what the homeowner does for the poor person gives back 100 times more to the homeowner. So what does that mean? Think about it. Let's say I invite someone for a meal. So I give them the challah and the gefilte fish and the chicken soup and the chicken and the kugel, of course. And they leave and hopefully they're happy. So that's from the perspective of the one who is the beneficiary. But what about me as the benefactor? I just acquired eternity. Because what I did for that person, by that person allowing me to give to them, gives me the opportunity to inherit the next world. That's eternity. So it could be that momentarily my pocketbook took a little hit, a couple shekels here or there. But what if we didn't have anybody who would allow us to do for them? What kind of world would we live in? We would live in a Sodom, Gomorrah, Moabite world where we wouldn't be allowed to help another individual. So we should always be conscious, wow, I have opportunities to do for others. And if that is our mindset, perhaps, that Boaz mindset, that Ruth mindset, then just think of what we could do and what we, how we can reunite our people. We need it, and God willing, we'll have, be sensitive to others. And those who are on the receiving end, allow someone else to do for you. Because it's not always easy. Sometimes your default position is, I'm okay, I don't need your help. But maybe by allowing a little bit of room for the other person, you cement a relationship, a mutuality between you, and it elevates everybody and everything. So we should be in the path of Ruth and Boaz. We should heal the rift that has come between the Jewish people, both here and in Israel, and have these mutual, beautiful, glorious relationships. Thank you, everyone.